In college, I fell in love with two women, Ember and Isla. They were both beautiful, and I knew they'd do anything for me. Before graduation, I needed to make a choice. In a way, I felt a deeper connection with Isla. She made me laugh in a way that Ember never could. We were just more compatible. However, Ember was quite rich. In the end, I chose her. Isla did not take the news well. She was heartbroken. She cut us both out of her life and promised me that I'd regret my decision. Ember and I married soon after that, and for the next 10 years, I didn't regret my decision at all. Ember took over her family business, so I didn't need to work. I could just stay home, living the good life. Everything was easy. But with Ember at work all the time, I got a little lonely sometimes. A man has needs. So, about a year ago, I started fooling around with my next-door neighbor, Helen. She came over a couple times a week, always in the middle of the day when Ember was working. One day, Helen and I were playing in the living room when a strange woman appeared at our door. I could see her through the window, staring at us. I freaked out, worried that this was one of Ember's friends. Helen hurried out the back door while I went through the front to ask who this stranger was. She was a horrid woman, grossly overweight and very dirty. She looked like she could have been beautiful if she hadn't completely let herself go.
"You're cheating on Ember?"
She knew my wife's name. Panicked, I started making excuses for myself, telling her that she misinterpreted what she saw. She interrupted me, a look of disgust on her pimply face.
"You don't remember me, do you?"
I didn't. I would have remembered meeting such a gross person. She refused to introduce herself, forcing me to take a long look at her and figure it out myself. As I stared into her eyes, I was filled with shock. This was Isla. She used to be so youthful looking, so beautiful. "Isla? What happened to you?" That was definitely not the right thing to say. She shoved me backwards and barged inside. Then she flopped her fat body onto the couch and waited for me to join her. I did.
"I'm not a hot young thing anymore, Rowan. After you broke my heart, I could barely take care of myself. You made me into this."
She waited for me to speak, but I didn't know what to say. I felt sorry for what she'd become, but I didn't feel guilty about it. People get dumped all the time. That doesn't mean they lose all sense of hygiene. When I didn't say anything, she started screaming. She said that I never should have married Ember. Worse, she said that she was going to tell her about my affair so that I'd lose her, too. That thought terrified me. I couldn't let this woman ruin my perfect marriage. I dropped down on my knees.
"Please, you can't tell her. Is there anything I can do to change your mind?"
A dark smile spread across her cold, sore, riddled lips.
"The only way to stop me from telling Ember about your affair is if your affair is with me. Since you're already down there, why don't you put that pretty little mouth to use?"
She wanted me to... Oh, no. I was disgusted. Based on her smell, I knew she didn't take care of her hygiene at all. I felt like throwing up. But I did what she asked. I had to. Afterwards, she left, and I took a long shower. I gargled mouthwash for like 20 minutes. Every day that week, she came back demanding the same thing. I always did what she asked, and I always felt horrible afterward. The fourth time she came back, I realized that she wasn't going to stop. She was using me, and she delighted my obvious revulsion. I couldn't do this anymore. As she stood in front of me and demanded that I drop to my knees, I grabbed the lamp next to me and slammed it against her head. I didn't mean to kill her. I wasn't sure what I wanted to happen, but that one hit was all it took. She dropped to the ground with a grunt. I'd killed her. I was mostly in shock when I wrapped her in a blanket dragged her body to my car, and dumped her in the reservoir. I tied her to a bunch of rocks so she'd sink to the bottom. I was so fat. LOL. Then I went back home, cleaned everything up, and pretended like nothing had happened. The police found her body 3 days later. Ember heard about it on the news. She came home in tears and told me everything. Even though Isla had been out of our lives for so long, Ember still felt terrible.
Who could do something so horrible to a sweet, beautiful girl like Isla?
Isla wasn't sweet, and she definitely wasn't beautiful anymore. I tried to comfort my wife, but I got tongue-tied. I think I finally felt guilty for what I'd done. I didn't feel anything when I disposed of her body. But now, all these negative feelings were hitting me all at once. Ember could see how upset I was. She hugged me and said, "It's okay. I'm sure the police will find her killer very soon. They always do." That was the worst thing she could have told me. Ember didn't go to work for the rest of the week. She could see how panicked and shaky I was, so she thought that I needed her support. She didn't know that her decision to stay home made everything harder for me. I couldn't look at her. I couldn't say anything. I was a nervous wreck. After days of this, she finally forced me to sit down and talk to her. She looked so loving and sympathetic.
"Rowan, Isla's death has really affected you, and I think I know why. I'm gonna ask you something, and you have to be completely honest with me, okay?"
In that moment, I knew that she suspected me of the murder. There were no other explanations. I nervously waited for her question.
"Honey, did you love her?"
That made me laugh out loud. No, of course not. She was disgusting.
She wasn't disgusting. She was beautiful and kind.
Back then. But in the last 10 years, she got really gross. Ember's eyes narrowed in suspicion. And that's when I knew I blew it. I told her before that I hadn't seen Isla since college. And now she knew that was a lie. I tried to think of an explanation, but nothing came to mind. I stammered for a while, which made me look really guilty, until finally I told her the truth. I killed her. I dumped her body in the lake. My wife's face went completely blank. Then she gave me a dim, sad smile and pulled me into an embrace. "Don't worry. No one else has to know." Without saying anything else, she walked out of the house. I sat in silence for hours, replaying that conversation over and over in my head, until Ember came back with a wide smile on her face. She kissed me on the forehead and said that everything would be okay. Her company had close ties with the police department, and she paid them in both money and favors to declare Isla's death an accident. Basically helped me cover up a murder with no words of judgment and no strings attached. I know I should be happy, but ever since that moment I've felt nothing but guilt and fear. Guilt for what I've done, and fear for what Ember will do next. I now know how deep her love goes, and how dark. This story is inspired from a real-life event. In March of 2025, a woman's body was discovered floating in the waters off Fort Totten in Queens, prompting an immediate investigation. A 911 call alerted authorities at around 11:15 a.m., and the NYPD Harbor Unit swiftly brought the body ashore. Nearby, police located a car in a parking lot with blood on the driver's seat and a knife resting on the passenger side, potentially linked to the case. The woman's identity remained unknown, and the city medical examiner was tasked with determining the cause of death. The chilling discovery raised more questions than answers as the investigation continues. Wendy was my high school girlfriend. She was smart and nice, but I always knew that our relationship was temporary. Graduation was coming up, and she had all these big plans about going to one of the state colleges in California.
That had always been her dream. I knew I'd never get accepted to one of those. I was just going to stay in Arizona and probably take classes at the community college. I didn't want to hold her back, so I figured that we'd go our separate ways. I even told her that. She understood. She knew that her dreams were more important than our relationship. To make her happy, though, I applied to all the same colleges she did, just in case. One day, I got home from school to find a stack of mail waiting for me. They were acceptance letters. I'd gotten into all three of Wendy's top schools. I couldn't believe it. I literally danced around the house in celebration before I called her to deliver the good news. When she answered the phone, I could tell she was crying. I got rejected everywhere. She was so upset that I couldn't tell her my good news. Instead, I stashed my acceptance letters in a drawer and asked if she wanted to come over and talk about it. When she showed up, she was an absolute wreck. Blotchy eyes, mascara down her face. She didn't even wipe the snot off her nose. I comforted her, like a good boyfriend, and told her that she'd be okay. She explained that she was so confident that she'd get accepted that she hadn't applied anywhere else. She thought her life was ruined. It took a while for me to calm her down. And when she finally did, she got this sad smile on her face. At least now we'll still be together. I couldn't hide my news anymore. I told her that I'd gotten accepted to all her dream colleges. I didn't know which one I was going to pick, but I was definitely going to go. Probably UCLA. That one had the best journalism program. She didn't say anything. Her face went completely blank. She stood up, wiped her eyes, and walked out of my house as if I wasn't there. She needed time to process her feelings, I guess. My parents came home a bit later, and I told them the good news. Dad happily agreed to pay for whatever wasn't covered by my scholarship. We had a celebration dinner and everything. I felt so freaking proud of myself. And for the rest of the evening, I didn't think about Wendy. Late that night, after I'd already gone to sleep, Wendy called me.
Hello?
You can't go!
We argued for a while, and I reminded her that if the tables had been turned, I would have supported her move to California. It wasn't fair that she wanted me to pass up the opportunity. She got really whiny, saying that I was ruining her life. She accused me of taking her spot, even though we'd applied for completely different programs. No matter what I said, she kept repeating that she wouldn't let me go. It was my duty to stay here with her. I know it sounds harsh, but after an hour of listening to her whine into the phone, I finally had enough. I broke up with her and ended the call. When I went to school the next day, I absolutely dreaded seeing her again. I hoped she would avoid me, but nope. She was waiting for me in the parking lot, like she usually did. She walked over, a big smile on her face, and kissed me as if nothing had happened. What are you doing?
I'm just taking care of my boyfriend.
I was too weirded out to confront her, so I forced a smile and we walked into the school together. For the rest of the day, she was in a great mood, making jokes, chatting with friends, acting super affectionate. It felt like she was trying too hard. At lunch, I told our friends about my plans to go to UCLA. They were all really excited for me. Wendy started acting really manic.
I got accepted too! We've decided to live off campus in a cute little apartment!
What are you talking about? She forced a laugh and then very quickly changed the subject. This kind of behavior lasted for days. She kept telling people about non-existent plans we made for the future. Buying a new car, enrolling in the same classes, sharing a meal plan. It was just so weird. And whenever I confronted her about it, she'd start laughing and change the subject. I was really starting to think she'd lost it. I was so concerned that I called her mom. She knew about Wendy's rejection letters, but I guess Wendy told her that we were both planning to stay in town and take community college classes together. I had to level with her. I explained that I was going to California. I even said that Wendy and I had broken up, but she kept acting like we hadn't. Her mom didn't say anything for a long time. Then, she screamed into the phone, "You bastard! You stole her spot!" Wow. Her mom was just as crazy as her. I decided then and there that I needed to stay as far away from Wendy as possible. That evening, I stayed up in my room, calling the UCLA admissions office and officially accepting the offer. The lady was super nice and answered all my questions. She said that she was really impressed by my personal statement. I felt a little guilty because Wendy had actually written my personal statement for me. I didn't tell her that, though. Hours later, Mom called me downstairs for dinner. She was in the kitchen, but Wendy was sitting at the table, a big smile on her face. Mom didn't know how Wendy had been acting the last few days.
Hi, honey.
I know it's rude, but I told her to leave.
Not until I tell you my new idea. You're gonna love it.
She stood up, pulled an electric razor from her pocket, and started shaving her head. Her long, blonde hair fell in clumps onto the dinner table.
Since you never wanted to go to UCLA, and they accepted you by mistake, then I'm going to take your spot. Don't you see? I'll pretend to be you. They'll never know.
That's when my mom walked in with a platter of food. She dropped it onto the floor completely in shock. Wendy turned to her with crazy eyes.
Hi, Mom!
I literally had to pull her out of the house. She didn't show up to school after that. No one knew what happened to her. Her mom won't answer my questions. I'm just worried that when I arrive on campus in a couple months that I'll see her there pretending to be me. This story is loosely inspired from a real-life experience of one of our Broccoli Fam subscribers. This is what he said. Back in high school, I dated a girl for a few months. When I got into my dream college, the one I'd wanted since I was a kid, I was thrilled and went to share the news with her. A couple of weeks later, she told me that she'd been rejected from every college except the local community one, despite taking AP and language classes. Then, she said we should move to Florida to live with her grandma and apply to schools there. I told her I wasn't ready to relocate after just a few months of dating. That's when she gave me an ultimatum. Her or my dream school. I've worked hard my whole life. I excelled at school, participated in a bunch of clubs, and did all the cooking and cleaning at home. My parents died when I was really young, so my older brothers, Henry and Andrew, had to sacrifice a lot to keep our family afloat. Neither of them finished high school because they needed jobs to support us. Because of their help and my hard work, I was able to attend a prestigious university on a scholarship. I couldn't afford living in the dorms, though, so I had to stay with my brothers and commute every day. I was doing well with my classes, but I had trouble making friends. Most of my classmates were from ultra-rich families. They took one look at me in my thrift store clothes and knew that I wasn't one of them. I thought that I'd escaped all that judgmental bullying once I'd graduated from high school, but it was so much worse in college. I felt like a pariah. I didn't tell any of this to my brothers, though. They both worked so hard as construction workers, so I felt awkward unloading my minor problems on them. They could tell I was upset, though. Especially Henry. He knew me better than anyone. One day, I came home from classes to find both my brothers waiting for me at the dinner table. Gia, you have to tell us what's bothering you. So I did. I unloaded everything on them. How everyone knew I was poor. How people avoided me and laughed behind my back. How I felt like a freak. I guess I was crying because Henry stood up and hugged me. Then he went back to Andrew. They whispered something to each other. But when I asked them what they were talking about, they refused to answer. All Henry said was, "Things will get better, we promise. Just hang in there." It was a weird conversation, but I didn't really think about it afterward. A week later, I came home from school to find Henry and Andrew excitedly waiting for me in the living room. They had a pile of clothes on the couch. What are these? Presents for you. We got a huge discount. My brothers were friends with a bunch of delivery guys, so it wasn't unusual for them to bring home stuff that had fallen off the back of a truck, so to speak. However, they had never brought home such a huge amount of stuff at one time. They had dozens of outfits, all in my size,
and each one looked new and expensive. I wrapped them both in a big hug and thanked them over and over. This was exactly what I needed to fit in at school. My classmates would finally stop treating me like a homeless person. I rushed up to my room to try on each outfit. Miraculously, every single one fit me perfectly. When I went back downstairs to show them my favorite outfit, they were gone. Well, probably they had to get back to work. Alone in the house, I spent the next few hours studying. I had the news playing in the background just to help me concentrate. I wasn't really paying attention to the TV until a news report came on about a robbery. Two large men in ski masks robbed a high-end fashion store and made off with thousands of dollars of clothes. I looked up at the screen, my heart racing. They played security camera footage of the robbery. The two men were each armed with tasers, threatening the workers and acting really intimidating. Even though I couldn't see their faces, I knew it was Henry and Andrew. I watched in horror as my brothers threatened the poor shop assistants. When one man tried to stop them, Andrew tased him. The man fell to the floor, flopping around and whimpering. The robbers tased three employees during the robbery, including one man who suffered a heart attack. Police are requesting any information to help identify these men. I couldn't breathe. I was having a panic attack. My brothers had robbed that store because of me. And now someone was in a life and death situation. What was I going to do? I couldn't turn them in, but I couldn't stay silent about this. If they got away with it, then I'd feel guilty for the rest of my life. It took me a long time to catch my breath. After that, I couldn't concentrate on my textbook. I couldn't do anything besides sit there and wait for my brothers to come home. They didn't. I tried calling both their phones. They didn't answer. I was a nervous wreck. I didn't know if they were hiding out, if they had already been arrested, or if they'd simply run away. Then, hours later, they came back. They were both very drunk.
You're still awake? I thought you'd be asleep by now. How do you like the clothes?
Did you see the news?
We were at a bar, just hanging out. Why? What news?
So I told them that I knew what they did, and I told them that one of the workers was critical because of them. Andrew didn't say anything. He just kept his head down. But Henry absolutely freaked out. He hadn't realized that the man had died. He started babbling. I couldn't understand what he was saying. Then he turned to Andrew and focused all his panic and anger on him.
It's your fault. The tasers were your idea. You're the one who zapped him. You're the real monster.
Henry dove at Andrew. I've seen my brother's horse around before, but I'd never seen them actually fight. It was brutal. Henry pinned Andrew to the ground and punched him in the face. Andrew struggled to free himself, but he couldn't. So he pulled the taser out of his pocket and zapped Henry. Henry spazzed out and fell to the side, his head striking the edge of the coffee table. When he flopped onto the ground, he stopped moving. The shock of that moment sobered Andrew up. He crawled to our brother and shook his shoulders, but it was useless. Henry had a bloody gash on the side of his head, and his eyes were rolled back. Andrew's face was horrifyingly blank as he stood up, walked over our brother's dead body, and disappeared out the front door without saying a word. I checked to make sure Henry was dead. He was. Then I called 911 and tried to explain what happened. I was sobbing so hard that I don't think they understood me. But they sent someone anyway. 10 minutes later, the paramedics took Henry's body away, and an officer asked me for my statement. I told her everything as best as I could. It all happened so fast. Before I knew it, Henry's body was gone. The paramedics were gone. The policewoman was gone too, taking all my new clothes with her. This all happened a month ago. The police are still looking for Andrew. I promised to call them if he tried to contact me, but he hasn't. I also dropped out of school. My heart's not in it anymore. Besides, without my brothers, I need to work full-time to survive. This story is loosely inspired from a real-world event. On March 6th, 2025, a bold daylight theft rattled Midtown Manhattan. Around 1:15 p.m., two shoplifters entered Bloomingdale's on 3rd Avenue and 59th Street, swiping over $6,500 worth of clothing. When store employees attempted to intervene, one suspect brandished a sparking taser, threatening to shock anyone who tried to stop them. The duo, both wearing hooded jackets and sunglasses, fled the scene with their stolen goods. No injuries were reported, but the act left employees shaken. Police later released surveillance images of the suspects and appealed to the public for help in identifying the two men behind the brazen theft. Mia was a beautiful woman, but she had some serious body issues. Her ex-husband Derek treated her horribly, constantly pointing out minor flaws and making her feel like an ugly whale that no one would ever love. The marriage ended 2 years ago, but the emotional scars remained. She met a new man, John, who finally made her feel like the smart, beautiful woman she really was. John and Mia loved each other dearly, and if things had been different, they would have married this December. Mia spent months planning the wedding. She wanted everything perfect. There was still a part of her whispering in the back of her brain, telling her that she didn't deserve someone like John. As the wedding got closer, she became more anxious. She was barely eating anything, trying to get as thin as possible. Everyone else could see that she was absolutely gorgeous, but when she looked at her reflection, she hated the image that looked back. She decided that she needed plastic surgery, just a little liposuction around the stomach and fillers on her butt. John had plenty of money, but she didn't dare ask him. Instead, she found a budget-friendly clinic that could give her everything she wanted at a fraction of the price. In her heart, she knew that this was a bad idea. The clinic itself was located in a run-down warehouse with no signage in the front. But still, she couldn't stop herself. When she arrived at her appointment, the doctor greeted her directly. No receptionists, no one else in the building at all, just her and an old man in a lab coat. He tried to calm her nerves and assure her that, even though he no longer had his license, he was a great doctor. She didn't believe it, but she followed him into the operating room anyway. The doctor set her up on the table, administered the anesthesia, and she drifted off to sleep. She never woke up. Hours later, John came home from work. He had a particularly good day, landing two new accounts. He couldn't wait to tell his fiancée the good news. She wasn't home. He tried calling her phone, but she didn't answer. He checked the calendar to make sure she didn't have any appointments. After checking with her mother, he really started to worry. This wasn't like her at all. He called the police. They promised to help, but they didn't have a lot of information to go on. Eventually, John found an address written on a post-it note. He knew it was in a sketchy part of town, and there was some part of him that knew with absolute certainty that this was where she'd gone. He drove there right away, immediately nervous at the sight of the crumbling warehouse. Without any backup plan, and with no one knowing where he was, John stepped inside. The place was filthy. It looked like a makeshift medical office. The door was unlocked, but no one was there. He looked around the waiting room, wincing at the stains on the tile. Then he pushed his way into a hallway. Finally, he heard a noise. Footsteps behind a door. He entered an operating room and saw what was left of his fiancée.
Mia?
His brain couldn't process what he was seeing. This was his beautiful fiancée, dead on a slab. It couldn't be possible. There had to be a mistake. This morning she'd been so full of life, and now she was gray and empty.
I am so sorry for your loss.
John spun around to see a man in a blood-stained lab coat, the butcher who had done this to the love of his life. The man stepped closer, explaining that Mia had a complication with her liposuction. He sounded guilty and regretful,
But as he got closer, John could see the needle in his hand. John was a witness to his illegal practice, and now the doctor was going to get rid of him. John pretended like he didn't notice. He waited for the doctor to get close enough before he grabbed the metal tray covered with the surgical tools and slammed it into the man's face. The doctor toppled backward, the syringe rolling out of his hand. John grabbed it and placed the needle next to his neck.
Why did you do this to her?
Because she was stupid and thought she wasn't beautiful.
John was filled with rage, though it wasn't all directed at this murderous doctor. Half of it was directed at Derek, Mia's ex-husband, the man who had spent years teaching Mia that she was ugly, that she needed fixing. He jabbed the needle into the doctor's neck and injected the knockout liquid that was meant for him. Then, he locked him inside the room with the remains of his wife and walked away. 10 minutes later, he was at Derek's house. He'd never met the man before, but he'd heard plenty of stories about him. As always, Derek was drunk, so it didn't take a lot of effort to convince him to go with John for a free consultation at a brand new medical clinic. John took him back to the warehouse and led him into another operating room, where the drunken idiot sat and waited. By then, the doctor had woken up. Here's the deal. I'll let you leave before I call the police, as long as you do one final surgery. Can you do that? The doctor agreed. Make sure you treat your new patient exactly how you treated Mia. The doctor understood exactly what he meant. So, John led him to the other room where Derek was waiting for what he deserved. John shut the door behind him, feeling the sick thrill of revenge racing through his heart. While the doctor performed his very last surgery, and Derek took his very last breath, John called the police. Despite what he promised, he didn't wait to call them. This story is loosely inspired from a real-life event. In 2025, a 38-year-old man was arrested after an illegal plastic surgery procedure at his home left a 31-year-old woman brain dead. The victim went into cardiac arrest after receiving a lidocaine injection for butt implant removal. The medics discovered a makeshift clinic in his Astoria apartment. The man, unlicensed in the U.S., fled but was arrested at the airport. Prosecutors cited lidocaine toxicity as the likely cause. The victim remained on life support with no brain activity.
My grandma is 92, and she refuses to go to a retirement home. Last year, my brother Andy and I decided to move in with her to make sure she didn't hurt herself. It was a difficult situation for both of us, but we loved our grandma very much. We weren't allowed to change much about her house when we moved in, but I made sure to upgrade her TV so that we could watch Netflix. I had a pretty busy job, so I didn't have time to watch a lot of movies. But Andy was home a lot more than I was, and I knew that he had his favorite shows that he always binged. One night, I came home from work while Andy was out with some friends. I checked in on Grandma, who was asleep in her room as usual, and decided to check out Netflix. I was scrolling through the movies when I noticed something weird. There were dozens of half-finished documentaries in the continue watching queue. I knew that Andy usually preferred stupid comedies, and I'd literally never seen him watch a documentary before. I started going through the titles and realized that every documentary was about people murdering their family members. It was the kind of true crime stuff that I'd never really seen before. One was about a wife poisoning her husband. Another was about a daughter murdering her parents and then hiding the bodies. But most of them were about children and grandchildren killing off their elderly relatives so they could get their inheritance. At first, I didn't think much of it. I know that when people are binging TV shows, they sometimes go down these weird rabbit holes and end up watching things that you wouldn't expect them to watch. But the more I thought about it, the more unnerved I got. This didn't feel like innocent binge watching. It felt like research. The only explanation I could think of was that Andy was planning on murdering our grandma. We both knew that we were the only beneficiaries in her will. Grandma had a lot of money saved up, and once she died, we'd inherit the house along with millions of dollars. I never would have thought that Andy would be sick enough to hurt someone like our grandma. But just in case, I decided to keep an eye on him. For the next few weeks, I spent more time at home. I started noticing little things, like how Andy always made Grandma's meals and organized her medication. While I offered to help, he refused. It really seemed like he was hiding something. I never said anything to him or Grandma, but I noticed Grandma would always glance at him suspiciously whenever he gave her the nightly pills. I also saw that he was watching more of those true crime documentaries on Netflix, though he never watched them when I was in the room. I just saw them pop up in the watch again and continue watching cues. It really should have said something, but I was honestly getting a little scared. One night, I came home early from work and decided to talk to Grandma. I kept things pretty vague, but I asked her how she was feeling and if something was bothering her. She told me that she could barely get out of bed and that she always felt worse after she took her medications. That's when I knew Andy was slowly poisoning her like in those documentaries. I kissed her on the forehead and told her that everything would be okay. About an hour later, Andy got home and walked straight into the kitchen. He didn't realize that I was there. I watched him as he fixed Grandma her tea and organized her pills. When he was finished, I told him that I could take everything up to Grandma's room. He refused, so I made up an excuse about having car problems and asked him to go check it out in the garage. I knew that that would keep him distracted long enough. He hurried outside, which gave me enough time to dump out her tea and make a new cup myself. I also took out the pills that he put on her plate and replaced them with the new ones from her medicine box. I figured that if Grandma didn't get sick that night, then I'd know that Andy was poisoning her. I had just finished pouring her replacement tea when a voice shouted at me from the hallway. "What are you doing?" I turned around and saw Grandma glaring at me. I told her that I was just getting her pills ready, but she didn't listen. She started charging toward me. "You're the one poisoning me," she screamed. "I thought it was Andy, but it was you all along." "No," I told her. "I would never." "I saw you," she screamed. "You dumped out my tea and replaced it with poison. You're just as bad as those psychos on TV." That's when I realized the truth. Grandma was the one watching those documentaries when we weren't around. Andy was never trying to kill her. She just thought that he was. And now her suspicions had turned towards me. I tried to explain myself, but Grandma was hysterical. I'd never seen her move so fast. She slammed me up against the counter and reached around to open a drawer. She pulled out a butcher knife. "I thought you loved me," she screamed. Before I could move, she took the knife and slammed it straight through my hand and into the kitchen counter. It happened so fast, my brain couldn't register the pain at first. Then she punched me right in the face. I couldn't believe how strong she was for a 90-year-old woman. I tried to move out of the way, but my hand was pinned to the counter. I grabbed the handle of the knife and quickly pulled it out. Then I threw the knife across the room so Grandma couldn't grab it. I started to scream for help, but Grandma grabbed me by the throat and squeezed. I couldn't breathe. With her free hand, she snatched the cup of tea and started pouring the hot liquid down my throat. "Drink it," she screamed. "Drink your poison." I coughed up as much as I could. I was slowly blacking out until all of a sudden, her hand let go of my throat. I fell to the floor, gasping for air. When my eyes could finally focus, I looked up and saw that Andy had returned. He was holding Grandma's arms behind her back. He ordered me to call the police. Andy struggled to hold Grandma in place without hurting her for about 5 minutes. When the ambulance finally arrived, they sedated Grandma and took her away. A paramedic bandaged my mangled hand. All this happened about 3 months ago. Since then, Grandma has been living in an assisted care facility where they've been giving her new medicine to help with her paranoia. Andy and I visit her every week.